I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, as the federal government once again tiptoes toward another possible shutdown, we're going to look at an issue that divides Congress, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DREAMers. We're going to talk about who they are and what they mean to America and Indiana. My guests are immigration lawyer Fatima Johnson and former DACA recipient Victoria Hicks. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits at wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about the one of the controversial programs that has created deep divisions, or been the source of deep divisions in Congress. I'm not sure created is the right verb choice there. I suspect those divisions would be there anyway. And that is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which involves the folks who are known as the DREAMers. We're going to be talking about this with two guests, Fatima Johnson, who is an immigration lawyer, and Victoria Hicks, who is a former DACA recipient. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
It's good to have both of you here. And I should point out that we cast the net far and wide to try to find folks who might be on the other side of the question here, and they all declined the invitation to appear on the program and talk about their positions and their experiences. We would invite, though, everyone to take part in this conversation, and you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So, Fatima, I'm going to start with you real quickly. If you could tell me, give us an overview of what DACA is.
Okay. So DACA is basically, in the simplest of terms, an exercise of prosecutorial discretion. And let me simplify that even more. The government has a limited amount of resources. And there's no way that everyone can be deported who is here and who is undocumented. So what happened with DACA was that basically they were given an exercise. They gave an exercise of prosecutorial discretion to low priority cases if they met certain guidelines. And that means that they know that the government acknowledges that these people are here without documents. But they are saying, we are not going to deport you right now. And with that DACA status comes a work permit and just the ability to kind of live a normal life. To qualify for DACA, you had to have been in the United States when you were under the age of 31. And that was as of June 15, 2012. You have to be under the age of 31. You had to have come to the United States before reaching your 16th birthday. You had to have continuously lived in the United States since June 15, 2007. And you had to be physically present in the United States on June 15, 2012. And the last requirement was that you had no lawful status on June 15, 2012. There were other guidelines that DACA recipients had to meet as well, meaning they had to either be currently in school or graduated from a high school or obtained a general education diploma, and they could not have been convicted of a felony, a significant misdemeanor, or multiple misdemeanors.
How did they define significant misdemeanor?
I know, that's the hard part, right? Yeah. Significant misdemeanor.
It's always the adjectives that get you into trouble.
those are the misdemeanors that are probably more serious. So if you're driving under the influence of alcohol, that's a significant misdemeanor. If you've been convicted of domestic violence or violence against a person, that's significant. If you've been caught with a firearm or used a firearm, that's a significant misdemeanor.
Okay. So, Victoria, you are one of these people that everyone's talking about these days.
Indeed I am.
So if you would, tell me your story.
So I was born in Mexico, okay. And my parents immigrated to the United States when I was 11 years old. Most of my childhood would be defined as a regular childhood. I went to school here. I did a lot of extracurriculars that you would expect, marching band. I participated in sports, and I really didn't know that I was undocumented until I was a senior in high school, and I tried to go to college. Up to that point, I was a 4.0 student. I had already been accepted to a lot of universities. I wanted to achieve a college education, except that I came to quickly realize that I could not get financial aid. I could not get scholarships. I could not get most loans. So education these days is really, really expensive. Mm-hmm. And without the means to pay for it, it's kind of a restriction in it. And that's when I really realized what being undocumented is. Before then, I thought I was just different. Mm-hmm. I couldn't put my finger in it, but I knew that something was off, and I just didn't know how. And then senior year of high school, it crashed on me just how different I was. So I am a stubborn human being.
Okay.
Raised by a very stubborn mother, mm-hmm. and we did not give up. I found small scholarships to help me on the way that I was eligible for, and mm-hmm. I worked my way through undergraduates. I worked Friday, Saturday, and Sunday 12-hour shifts as a waitress, mm-hmm. and the rest of the week I went to school. And I actually graduated summa cum laude 3 years ago.
Okay.
But it wasn't all easy because, do you want me to talk about
Well, yeah,
right
what
now?
I was going to step in, when you say you grew up here, you mean here in Indianapolis or?
In Bloomington, Indiana.
In Bloomington, Indiana, where, mm-hmm. which high school did you go to?
Bloomington High School South,
Bloomington
home of the
high
Panthers.
School, okay, all right, so we're establishing, and where'd you go to college?
Indiana University of Bloomington.
Okay, so you stayed close to home there.
Yeah.
What were the circumstances that brought your family here to this country?
What, you know, I think my father got a job here when I was very young, and eventually we brought the family over. And I, you know, I've never been told, but I think we fell out of status somehow, and we just stayed out of status because we couldn't get back into status.
And I don't mean to, I know what you mean, but I suspect there are people who don't because there are a lot. When you say we fell out of status, what do you mean by that?
We overstayed our visa.
Okay.
And I was never privy to this conversation. Keep in mind, I was 11 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly why DACA is so important, because children don't have an option of being brought here.
Mm-hmm.
We're told, and we're not given an option of whether we want to come or stay. We're not giving that freedom. So when we're here and we're being penalized by something that we didn't do, it feels really horrible. Because we feel American, and we didn't really do anything wrong. So DACA gives us a way to achieve a level of normalcy.
Fatima, how many folks are in positions similar to Victoria's? Do we have numbers on this?
Well, in Indiana alone, there's about 10,000.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, there's more than 10,000. There's about 10,000 people who have Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. There's even more people who have been here but don't meet the educational requirements, probably about 4,000 of them. And there's probably, I would say, about 4,000 people who, if the program continued, would become eligible.
So that's the equivalent of a pretty good-sized town.
Really, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's an Indianapolis suburb all by itself, basically. So you've talked about, Victoria, the challenges that you and your family faced when it came to getting ready to go to college and all of that. What are the other things that your status as undocumented or as a DACA recipient, and I'm not even sure recipient is the right term there, but we're struggling to find another noun for that. What is the other ways that you are affected by this, or your life has been affected by this?
So before deferred action, there's a great deal of fear involved in being undocumented. because of the knowledge that at any moment you could be deported. It's very difficult to live in Indiana without having a car. And by necessity, a lot of undocumented people drive to work, to school, any of the above, grocery store. So if you speed, you can get pulled over. You can get deported. If you don't stop for a stop sign, you can get pulled over. If you get the wrong cop, you get deported. Like, there's so many ways along that pathway that you can just fall over and get out and be completely shut out from the life that you've known. And it just goes in every way. Like, finding a job when you're undocumented is almost impossible. People find a way, but it's not always easy. Finding resources, finding doctors, like, that won't tell on you. Traveling within the United States is very difficult. Like, life just gets way more difficult when you're undocumented. And thanks to deferred action, the fear is kind of taken away. To a certain extent, because with deferred action, I got a social security number so I could work legally and I didn't have to worry about my employer finding out that I was undocumented. I got a driver's license so I can drive without constantly being afraid of cops. I could go to school without having to explain time and time and time again why there's no social security number in my papers. It just made life a little less complicated.
How old were you when you achieved DACA status?
I was in my 20s.
Okay,
so I'm 29 now.
So it's relatively recent then.
Yeah, I've reapplied for it twice.
Okay. If you are just joining us, we are talking about the Dreamers, about those young folks who are. Who have DACA status, that's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, that have been at the center of so much discussion in the United States. If you would like to join this conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So, Fatima, I want to ask, you know, in terms of this, how large, you know, you're an immigration lawyer, what are some of the legal hurdles that go into achieving DACA status?
Well, I would say the majority of people who want to apply for DACA and can't either don't meet the educational requirements. Maybe they came to the United States when they were young, but they did not go to school. Or maybe they came when they were on the cusp of turning 15 or 16 or turning 16, and they have to prove exactly when they came into the country, and sometimes that documentation isn't there. Also, there's been a lot of changes, and the only people who can renew DACA are people who had it before. There's not any new applications that are being accepted right now. So for those people, there's even in September of last year, they had to come up with a filing fee relatively quickly within a month to apply to renew. No matter what time they apply, whether you give them a year or 2 years or a month, sometimes it's hard to come up with $500. I can count on my hand. I can count on both hands and both feet. And I still need your hands and feet the number of times I've been $500 short of a goal. Mm-hmm. So they have to pay $500 every time they want to renew their status. And that's a real challenge for a lot of my clients, at least.
And is it a process? I mean, do they have to go through a court? What is the actual?
They don't have to go through a court. It's an affirmative process. So they fill out an application. They get documentary evidence and they send it to immigration to be processed. They provide all of their evidence about where they lived and how they've been in the country continuously.
And how long, you know, after they send it off, how long is the process that they have to wait for an answer, generally?
Oh, that's the question that all my clients have. And the answer is always, it depends. Processing times have ranged from anywhere from 4 months for renewals or sometimes less to over a year.
For a year. And if it and there are no fresh ones being done now. So all of the renewals, they're all in renewals. And how often do you have to renew?
You have to renew every 2 years.
Okay. So it's not a perpetual thing. It doesn't relieve that. Victoria's shaking her head back and forth.
Right.
It doesn't relieve you then of the the challenge or the stress of worrying completely, right, Victoria?
No, and it's also not a pathway to citizenship. So it's not a permanent status. You have to continuously be on status and make sure that you still qualify for it. So it's more complicated than it sounds.
We are talking about people who have DACA status, the dreamers here on No Limits today. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Fatima Johnson. She is an immigration lawyer, and Victoria Hicks, who is both a former and current DACA recipient. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about those people who have DACA status. They are the deferred action for childhood arrivals. That doesn't just flow off the tongue, folks. I'm sorry. Or the dreamers. I'm beginning to understand why they went with another name for them, because it does flow more easily. My guests are Fatima Johnson, who is an immigration lawyer, and Victoria Hicks, who is both a current and former DACA status person. And I said this at the top of the show, but I want to reiterate, we issued invitations to as many people as we could think of to appear on the program to talk about their concerns about undocumented immigration and DACA and all of that, and virtually every one of them declined to appear on the air. So I just want to make it clear, in case someone is thinking about calling and asking about that, that's the reason that we're talking. We talk with the folks who are obviously willing to talk about the issue. So I want to ask real quickly, because, you know, the president now has said, or at least there are indications coming out of the White House, that he may not approve any new renewals after March 5, I think it is. I started with Fatima last time, but this affects you directly. You know, how do you react to that? I mean, what's the effect that would have on your life?
Well, I want to be completely transparent here. I actually got married very recently, so I'm going to be out of this danger zone very soon. But I can tell you that I did live through it for a little while, and it's terrifying. The idea that you have built a life on steady footing, having documents and like going to school, getting a career, starting a job, and then to have all of that taken that away very suddenly, which is what it looks like is going to happen, it's just terrifying. I mean, there's a lot of doctors that have come through the process that are DACA students that are not able to practice anymore, will not be able to practice anymore because their licenses depend on them being legal here. And I mean, that's just one. There's business owners, there are students, there are college students. There are so many jobs that, like, there's so many people that depend on this. And it's just terrifying to know that that's going to go away.
Fatima, how many of your clients are folks who have DACA status, and how are they reacting to all of this uncertainty?
I would say there's probably about 20% of my clients have DACA, and some of my employees as well. Mm-hmm. And the reaction has been one of fear, one of anger, one of disbelief at some of just even the comments that people make to them. One of my employees commented, she said she's not even concerned about herself. She feels bad for her friends, for her family members, who people are talking about in terms to make them sound like bad people. She's like, we're not bad people. And so March 5th is the deadline. But I'm sorry, March 8th. I'm thinking of someone's birthday. Mm-hmm. March 5th, March 8th is the deadline. But even though the deadline is in March, DACA probably will not just disappear in March, because right now there's so much back and forth in the courts right now that it will probably linger on, depending on when a Supreme Court decides to review the case. It could be a year. It could be months. Just no one knows. And that uncertainty is daunting.
We are talking about the Dreamers, folks who have deferred action for childhood arrivals status here on No Limits today. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Emil has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Emil, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I really just wanted to call and thank all of you for what you're doing. I wanted I just joined. I sort of stumbled upon the radio station by accident. Ms. Victoria Hicks, I'd really like to thank you for standing up for what you believe in. I know that takes a lot of courage. From one DACA recipient to another, thank you. Thank you, Mr. John.
You can drop the mister. I'm John. Anyone who calls the show is a friend of mine, so we'll go with first names.
That's really all I have to say. And I guess if you, I can probably speak to one of your secretaries after we get off the phone. And I would also be willing to speak with you about it, about this, seeing as how no one else wanted to.
Well, actually, it's the folks on the other side of the question. We couldn't get to talk about it. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But that's all I wanted to say.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Thank you very much
for
calling me.
Hang in there. I know it's a little scary right now, but it'll be okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, that kind of speaks to this. We probably ought to talk about, and in some ways, Fatima, I'm going to ask you to frame the other side's argument, but as a lawyer, you probably have to anticipate that to deal with it anyhow. What is the controversy about here? Why are so many people so exercised about this?
I think that The lines have been drawn politically. And, you know, the thing I learned in law school is you can make an argument for just about anything. So the law, we have a president who was we had a president who was a constitutional law professor who believed that it was within his rights to exercise prosecutorial discretion to give protection to this group of young people. And a lot of people did not agree with that, but on the other hand, I don't think they would have agreed with a lot of things that he would have said if he would have been on the other side. He deported a lot of people as well, Obama.
Actually, more than Trump, apparently.
Yes, so far. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people were deported. A lot of people, it was a different time when if you got stopped for driving without a license, you knew you were going to be put into removal proceedings. And it kind of took a turn in the second term towards, okay, now we have all these people in removal proceedings and we cannot handle them. I had people who were being scheduled for trials 6 years out, 7 years out. So that's just a little taste of what would happen if you didn't choose who was a priority for deportation. And the people who have DACA are very vulnerable and trusted the government to give and gave them all their information. All their information, gave them all their addresses they've lived at since they've been in the United States. That means their parents' addresses. That means their sisters, their brothers, their aunts, their uncles, people who do not have the same protections. And right now, that's why people are fighting so hard to keep them in status, because they trusted the government to do what they said they were going to do. And now this is just kind of the rug has been pulled from underneath them. On the other side of the argument, people think that it's kind of like a blanket amnesty. And they think, oh, well, why don't they just get in line and wait? And they don't, what they really don't know, there is no line for them to wait in. They are stuck with no status. There's nowhere for them to go to. It's really a humanitarian issue.
And I want to pick up on something Fatima said and ask Victoria about, because a lot of the rhetoric around this does focus on, you know, supposed abuses of the system by, you know, people who are undocumented. The president made reference, obviously, to, you know, a particularly vicious murder in Long Island during the State of the Union. We're seeing a lot of loose chatter about the, you know, the drunk driving death of the Indianapolis Colts player here, the fact that the person who was driving that car was undocumented. As Fatima said, a lot of people, you know, tend to lump everyone who is undocumented into that group. I would think that's got to be more than a little infuriating or frustrating, Victoria.
It is. I mean, we can take it back all the way back to when Trump referred to all. I think he said all Mexicans are the worst, like the Mexicans that are here are the worst that Mexico could send. Mm-hmm. And that's really insulting because I don't feel like the worst thing that Mexico could send. Keep in mind that DACA students have to meet this really, really high burden of like proving that we're good for society, that we are upstanding parts of our community, that we don't have any criminal record, and that we're actively doing something with our life. The students, these DACA recipients, they're the best that other countries are sending. So it's sad that they lump everyone together. And I'm not saying that undocumented immigrants, all undocumented immigrants are bad. That's far from the truth.
Or good, you mean?
Or good. I mean, bad or good. There's all types of people.
We are talking about the Dreamers here on No Limits today. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Stephen has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Stephen, you're on the air.
Thank you. I appreciate this.
Certainly.
I guess my observation is that people that oppose this program on ideological grounds are thinking pretty much in an isolated vacuum. And it's wonderful to hear the voice of the young lady who is living this. It's just an ideology that really is serving no purpose. It seems very mean-spirited. Just totally unrealistic, out of touch. It's just like I want to have my way because I've got some sort of principled belief that if you're not here originally through the legal process, that therefore there's no merit in you staying here. And that kind of ideological position in the vacuum is dangerous, and it just doesn't reflect what this country's about. And I just wanted to get that off my chest. So thank you for the program. I appreciate it.
Certainly. Thank you very much for the call, Stephen. So and I'm going to deal with it because I think, you know, a lot of the concerns you hear, we've sort of touched on the whole crime thing that and I realize you probably wanted to be careful. But he said that also the president said at one point that everyone who came here was a murderer, rapist or a thug. You know, he used some other probably racially charged language when he made reference to bad hombres and all of that sort of stuff. The other argument that, though, is perhaps less inflammatory but maybe more damaging over the long haul is the argument that all of these folks come here, and I'm trying to paraphrase their argument as best I can, consume all of our services and become a burden on the taxpayers. I'm going to give both of you a crack at that one. I know I lobbed it out there, and I know it's going to come screaming back at me because I know the answer to the question.
Can I
Victoria?
Start?
Yeah, go ahead, Victoria.
I was actually talking to someone about this today.
Yeah.
Undocumented people and DACA students pay taxes actively every day. I mean, most people are not given an option. When you work, taxes are taken out of your paycheck. When you go to the grocery store, you pay the sales tax. I mean, these people are contributing taxes actively to society. However, they're not receiving anything from social programs. When you're undocumented or you're a DACA student, you don't have access to those programs. You need citizenship to be able to receive from those programs. So I actually don't know where they came up with this argument, because it's just, I don't see the truth in it. I can't get Social Security, yet I'm paying into Social Security. I can see American citizens benefiting from that.
Well, and that's, Fatima, I guess I'll throw that to you. I don't claim to have done exhaustive research on this, but most of the studies I have seen show that on average, the undocumented immigrants, they don't break it down in terms of DACA or Dreamers, actually pay twice as much in taxes as they consume in services. Is that a fair representation?
I would say it's a very fair representation. A lot of my clients have to prove, if they are in deportation proceedings, they have to prove that they've been paying taxes for at least 10 years. They do, and they pay taxes. If you don't have a Social Security number, you can use an individual tax identification number to pay taxes, and that's what most of them do. Apart from that, if their child, if who's a U.S. citizen, qualifies for Medicaid or qualifies for food stamps or qualifies for something like that, their household may be getting some assistance. But that undocumented person is not privy to those benefits. They cannot get food stamps. You'll see an approval letter, and you'll see all the people in the household that are excluded, and they will be one of those people who are excluded, yet they're paying into the system.
I've gotten a Facebook comment from a listener named James. And again, if you want to join the conversation via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. James writes, my questioning comment is our current immigration system set up to handle the influx of DACA cases? With the number of people that we're talking about, I would see how the system might be overwhelmed. Fatima?
I would say the system is probably overwhelmed even without the DACA recipients. However, this is a fee-based application process. So if So I would say that capacity building is something that could happen just because of the fees that are paid by DACA recipients. But the immigration system is notorious, just as other government agencies, they're notorious for delays. And I would say that finding a way to affirmatively help the people who are here with DACA status will be much less burdensome than trying to deport a commensurate amount of people.
So let me ask this real quick, Fatima. You made reference to that fee-based system. Where does that $500 go?
Where does that $500 go?
Per person, because by my math, I mean, that's about $7 million or maybe more. I may have missed a zero there.
Right, and the fees are ever increasing with immigration, and the forms are ever changing, and attorneys' fees are ever increasing because of the constant changes. But the $500 goes to the United States Department of Homeland Security. So, again, there's a lot of people who are funding programs that we have here to keep us safe, and to they're paying their way as they go. So
actually, these undocumented or DACA people with DACA status are in fact paying for defense of the United States. Is that correct?
I would say that's correct.
And that's the way this works. Okay. Well, that is interesting. We are talking about people who have deferred action for childhood arrival status here on No Limits, otherwise known as the Dreamers. And about the challenges they face and really what the issues are associated with them. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Fatima Johnson. She is an immigration lawyer. And Victoria Hicks, who is a former DACA recipient. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about people with DACA status, that's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, a.k.a. the Dreamers. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Susan has done and send us an email. Our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. And I should say that my guests are Victoria Hicks, who is a former DACA recipient, and Fatima Johnson, an immigration lawyer. Susan writes, "Hi, John, longtime listener. I am a big supporter of the DACA youth. However, I would like to hear your guest lawyer say more about why the DACA participants cannot apply for legal status or citizenship. This is the question I hear from the anti-DACA crowd. Frankly, I could not answer this. Thanks for your thoughtful program and best wishes to your guests." From Susan. Okay, Fatima, I think that's your cue.
Thank you, Susan. This is the question I get a lot as well. And it's usually easier to explain with the diagram, but I'm going to try to explain it.
Yeah, we're not a particularly visual medium here. Okay.
So if you are in the United States and you are over 18, and let's say you're here and you do not have any status, you start accruing what they call unlawful presence. Once you have 180 days of unlawful presence, you are subject to a 3-year bar before you are eligible for any kind of immigration status. And we're going to take DACA out the equation and not call it a status right now. But if you're going to get a green card, if you're going to get any other kind of visa, you have to leave the United States for 3 years before you can do that. And that's just from being out of status for 6 months. If you're out of status for 1 year or more, you are subject to a 10-year bar. So that means, let's say I meet the man of my dreams. We'll call him Denzel. And I meet Denzel, and he's been here in the United States, and he entered the United States without status. And he's been here for 5 years, and he's married to me, a U.S. citizen. It would be very difficult for me to help him. We have to pay thousands of dollars in immigration fees. We have to pay thousands of dollars in attorney's fees. He has to file for a waiver with the United States Citizenship Immigration Service, and he has to leave the country and come back. Most people cannot do that because of finances, and most people are not married to U.S. citizens, so there's that as well. And if you have multiple entries into the United States, it becomes even more difficult because then you're subject to a permanent bar. So there are many things. There's nothing for them to apply to, because if you go through the list of everything that everyone has to qualify for in order to get legal status here, they don't fulfill all the requirements for anything.
We are talking about people with DACA status, the Dreamers, here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Suzanne has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Suzanne, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you. And I really enjoy your show, but I do have kind of an emotional question. I have a friend who went out, and she had a couple of drinks one night. She's a very small person. She didn't realize she was really already over the limit. She had an accident and someone was killed, and she was sent to 14 years in jail. She had two small children. I just don't understand the difference. Hers was not an intentional thing. Yes, she did break the law, but she certainly never intended to kill anyone. And yet the illegal immigrants know every day that they're illegal. Every single day of their lives, they know they're illegal. And they could do something about it. Like she said, they could go back home and come back. And emotionally, I just can't see why we're supposed to be so sympathetic to these people, but not to the hundreds and thousands of kids whose parents are in jail, and they have to suffer too, and they're citizens of the United States. If you could discuss on that, I would really appreciate it.
Certainly. Thanks very much for the call, Suzanne.
All right. Thank you.
All right. I'll throw that one first to you, Victoria, because you've lived with that kind of, and it speaks to your, you know, the implication, you know you're here, you know you're not undocumented, that in effect you're outside of, at some level, outside of legal status. I'm loath to use the term illegal, but because I think that's a question that courts normally determine.
Well, I think it's a very complicated question, and I think you're almost comparing apples to oranges in that situation. Because I don't know if I mentioned earlier, but I'm a law student.
Yeah.
So I am very familiar with the criminal system. And I think the difference between being undocumented and committing a crime, even if you didn't mean to commit the crime, is that a lot of, today we're talking about DACA students, a lot of DACA students really don't have an option when they're brought here. And this is our home. When you arrive here at 2 years old, 10 years old, I was 11 years old, this is the only home we've ever known our entire lives. Like, this is where we build our lives. This is where our families are. This is the only society I've ever known to function in. So to ask us to leave is almost like a... It's almost like a life in prison sentence, because you are taken completely out of your life, and you're not going back to your country, you're going back to your parents' country. Whereas a person who drinks and drives, when you're drinking, when you take your driver's license test, you promise to uphold certain things, and you're aware that drinking is one of the dangers. Mm-hmm. And when you drink and drive, you're putting yourself in that situation. You're actively putting yourself out there. So whereas a DACA student didn't choose this life, they didn't choose to be brought here. So I think it's apples and oranges, but we're not asking for pity. We're just asking for an opportunity.
Fatima, I can tell you want to jump in.
If I could piggyback on that. And I think that's why it's really, really good if I diagrams help sometimes.
Yeah.
But
and I might add here, even after we go off the air, okay, if you want to load the diagram onto our Facebook
yes
page, that would be fabulous.
I think I will because Suzanne, there's no, when I say people can leave and come back, that was just a nat example I gave of me marrying Denzel, which
good luck with that, Fatima, by the way.
He's already married. But this normally for the most people, most of these recipients, they cannot come back. There's no way to bring them back. You can only come back through a job after you've been out of the country for 10 years. And if you are super duper special and there's no American citizen who can do your job, or you can come back through a family member petitioning for you. Now, let's say I have a U.S. citizen sister and she's 6 years old and I decide to leave the country. I have to wait until she's 21 years old for her to petition for me. So that means 15 years outside the country I'm waiting. So my 10-year bar is complete, but I still have to wait 15 years before she can apply for me. Then after she applies for me, let's say I'm from Mexico, I have to wait an additional 30 years in order to come back. So to take someone who does not know this is their country, they're American in every way except their status. To take someone and to say, go back there, go live there, start over, start something. You're going to be away from your friends. You're going to be away from your family who are citizens. Go somewhere you don't know. It's kind of cruel.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's arguing if there is no pathway for citizenship, then saying, well, they should become citizens is like saying they should learn to fly without a plane. Right. That, if there's not an avenue for that to become possible, then that's a false leader, a dead end.
Right. And it's not that it's citizenship. A lot of people say, why don't they become citizens? And you can't become a citizen without first being a green card holder for 3 to 5 years, depending on how you get your green card. And even then, there are a lot of hurdles. I'm an immigration attorney. I've been working on immigration cases even before law school as a Board of Immigration Appeals representative. It's been about 10 years that I've been doing this. My grandmother and mother just got their citizenship. We're originally from Panama. They just got their citizenship, and they've been here since the 60s. So sometimes there's pitfalls, there's stops, there's things along the road that you cannot control. Even when you come here legally.
We've gotten a message from a listener via Facebook. And again, if you want to join the conversation via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits, WFYI. Maria writes, as a former DACA recipient, I want to commend Victoria for not giving up on her school and dreams. I know what it is to be afraid to be sent back to an unknown country. I applied for DACA 3 times before I got married. I need to say I did not get married to fix my status, as some may think. I was able to travel out of the country with a travel permit, and once I was able to come back, I applied to fix my status. Now I am a permanent resident, but fear for my 2 brothers. He was able to apply for DACA with me, was not able to travel out because he was scared not being able to about not being able to come back to his wife and kids. My oldest brother was not able to apply because he was 33 at the time DACA came out, yet he qualified for all the other requirements. I really hope something will be done for the remaining Dreamers, not just my brothers, but for other well-deserving kids who study hard and apply themselves at school. We haven't really talked about this, other than we've alluded to the fact that DACA is really only a small piece of this puzzle, a relatively small piece. What are the options for all of those other people who would not qualify for DACA, like Maria's brother, Fatima?
The most hard part of my job is to, I meet with a lot of people, and the most hard part of my job is to tell people when there's nothing available for them, there's nothing I can do. And I spend the majority of my day saying there's nothing I can do. Immigration law is very strict. It's not flexible at all. There's not a lot of things that they can do, There's a lot of myths in the community, and people take advantage of unknowing immigrants and have them apply for things they don't qualify for. And then they get them in a world of trouble. But there's a lot of people here, and this is why the immigration system is broken. This is why we're saying it needs to be reformed, because they're here and they contribute to the country and they're American in every way except for their status. And there's still nothing we can do.
We are talking about DACA recipients on No Limits today. I've got a full bank of phone calls, so I'm going to ask our callers here, we want to try to get it to as many of you as possible, to be very concise in your questions or comments. And we will start with Khadisha. Khadisha, you are on the air.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
My question is, a lot of people assume that most of the DACA recipients are from maybe Hispanic countries or, you know, Latin American countries. What is the percentage or what is the number of DACA recipients that may not be from primarily Hispanic countries like some of the African countries or South Asian countries that are also affected by the DACA issue?
Good question. Thanks very much for the call, Khadisha. Certainly. I'll throw that one to Fatima.
I knew I was going to get this one. I would say that that the majority are from Mexico, but the second largest recipients of DACA, the country that represents the second largest recipient, is El Salvador, and Central American countries are really, really prevalent. I can also provide you a chart with a lot of the breakdown. I would say that there is an underrepresentation in at all times in countries from Africa, and DACA recipients from Africa kind of being represented in the media and things like that, but they still face the same challenges. Indiana specifically, the number one, the immigrants are most immigrants from Indiana are from Mexico, followed by Burma and China. I'm sorry, followed by Burma, China, and India, not necessarily in that order.
So a lot of it, and most of the focus is on either Hispanic Americans or Latin Americans, but it is much more complicated. I mean, I remember doing some research on this at one point and being stunned to discover that actually there are significant number of people from Ireland who have undocumented status here, and nobody seems to be at all upset about that, which is my way of raising, you know, is there an ethnic or racial component to these fears or concerns about this? Is there some sort of bigotry involved? Victoria, you've lived it. Can you speak to it?
I think it's a matter of who can pass through American society without being noticed easily. I think if you're from Ireland, you kind of blend in really well. Whereas if you're brown or you're a darker color or you're from another country and you have an accent, then it's a lot harder to blend in. And I think that's why certain countries are way more visual than others.
We are talking about DACA. I'm going to try to squeeze in at least one more phone call here on No Limits. Chris, you are on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Certainly.
Victoria, I think you said, your last comment about blending in. My question is, I'm in Indiana, Indianapolis in particular. Came from Los Angeles, though, and watched my great-grandparents, grandparents, parents all come in to this country, and in most cases undocumented. All have amazing histories in this country, contributed. Who is really behind the scenes in all of this that will benefit the most from, let's say, building a wall? Where is all the money going? Who's going to get the contracts? Who's going to... That's what I'd like to see addressed in the media and other places, because those of us who are immigrants or from immigrant families, we're not going to benefit. We might see citizenship down the road somewhere, but...
Let me step in, Chris.
We're going to continue to work hard. So who really gets the perks here?
Yeah, and the reason I'm stepping in is we're getting close on time toward the end here, and I want to give them a chance
Sorry
to respond.
That.
No. Thank you very much for the call and for the question. Fatima, I'll give each of you a crack at that. Who would benefit from excluding these folks, either through a wall or whatever device?
You know, I think that there would be no one who would actually benefit long term. I think short term, whoever's building the wall, the wall builders would benefit. The contractors would benefit. You would see the same misappropriation of funds that you see in Puerto Rico, that you see in other places when you have government contracts and just a big project that can't be supervised well. But the American worker would not benefit.
Victoria.
Really super quickly. I think what they're fighting is a boogeyman. They're using immigrants as like a boogeyman of saying, we can place all the blame here. So by building this wall, by doing this, it's kind of like, look, we beat the boogeyman, but it's not really going to fix any problem. No one's going to benefit from it.
So I'm going to ask, this is my last question. I'll come to Victoria. Where do you think of as home?
Bloomington, Indiana.
All right. Well, I would like to thank both of my guests, Fatima Johnson and Victoria Hicks, for what has been a provocative and informative conversation. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for some great questions as well, and invite everybody to come back on Thursday when we're going to be looking at the first half of the Indiana General Assembly session. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.